This is UU Todd Phillips, the golden voice of the Great Southwest. And once again, you're listening to Loafer's Glory, the hobo jungle of the mind. No. Tell us a story, he said. Your stories are trapped in books. A story is a letter from the past. You add your words and mail it to the future. Now, tell us a story. So I did. Hello, yeah, this is UU Todd Phillips, a.k.a. the golden voice of the Great Southwest, and I'm here in the studios of community station KVMR, Nevada City, California, holding the line against creeping mediocrity, especially in this an election year. Well, here we are here in Nevada City, up in the foothills. We've just passed Rosh Hashanah, Michaelmas, when we built the autumn fires. Yom Kippur is on its way. We're working our way down to Hanukkah, one of my favorite holidays of the year. Unfortunately, this year I will not be doing the annual Hanukkah Children's Party at Jewish Community Center in Grass Valley. I wish I could, but I don't know. Last year I made a Hanukkah pinata. It was a beautiful thing, too. And they were the kids blindfolded with their long broom handles and with pinata swinging, and they were bashing away at it until they finally fractured it. In honor of the occasion, I had filled it full of gehakta labor, chopped chicken liver, which, of course, rained down on the kids. It was pretty disgusting, I suppose. So I've been invited not to do that again this year. I taught the kids wonderful, wonderful folk art. I taught them Jewish origami. You know, Japanese origami is Japanese paper folding. Jewish origami is matzah folding. You've got to be quick. Here's like this. A little puppy. Oh, you missed it. Well, like I say, it's a little bit quick. Ah. Storytelling. That's what this program is going to be about, is storytelling. Some of the great storytellers that I've known and had a chance to work with across the country over many years. I remember visiting Doc Watson. I was working my way through the South, hitchhiking, riding, trying to find something in the world that I could latch hold of and put into my life, mainly of a musical nature. I heard that there was a fella in Deep Gap, North Carolina, that I needed to visit. Doc Watson wasn't out and traveling very much in those days. I showed up at his place the same day that he had finished rewiring the house. Now, Doc had been blind since birth, and he rewired the house, and the inspector was just leaving and said that it was done perfectly, and Annie approved it. It was also the day that he gave his son, Merle, his first good guitar. It was a Gibson Hummingbird. And we sat and talked, and I loved the way that he spoke. Of course, I love his music, but I love the way that he spoke. Let's listen to Doc Watson tell a story and then kind of a protracted dither.
Any of y'all ever been real lazy on a hot summer day? Well, this song kind of hits me. I have, I'll tell you, I'll guarantee you. It's a little narrative. Mr. Carson Robinson wrote part 1, 2, and 3 and recorded on the old 78 records. A fellow named Elton Britt grabbed it in the 40s. He was a sort of a cowboy type singer. He's called the Lonesome Cowpoke because he had a hit record called that, I guess. But he had a great big hit on this thing. It's called Life Gets Tedious, Don't It? Richard? If you'll cover up my mistakes on this, I'll try to pick it and narrate it for these folks. The sun comes up and the sun goes down. The hands on the clock go round and round. I just get up and it's time to lay down. Life gets tedious, don't it? Shoes untied, but shucks, I don't care. Reckon I ain't going nowhere. I'd wash my face and I'd comb my hair, but it's too much wasted effort. I open the door and the flies swarm in, and when I shut the door, I'm sweating again. In the process, crack my shin. There's one darn thing after another. Philip, I'll dedicate this to you. The cow went dry and the hens won't lay, and the fish all quit biting last Saturday. My troubles keep piling up day by day, and now I'm getting dandruff. 10 roof leaks and the chimney leans, and there's a hole in the seat of my old blue jeans. Well, I've ate up the last of the pork and beans. Can't depend on nothing. The water in my well is getting lower and lower. I can't take a bath now for 6 months or more. Well, I've heard it said, and it's true, I'm sure, that too much bathing will weaken you. Keeps howling so forlorn. You know, that's the laziest dog that ever was born. He's a howling because he's a setting on a thorn, and he's just too tired to move over. My mind's gone so slow that I can hardly think. My head's gone as bald as the kitchen sink. Mosquitoes have been using it for a skating rink. Just can't hardly stand it. Sent my boy off to music school. He promised me he'd learn every single rule. Well, he's back home now, and what do you think of that? He's playing that hillbilly music and wearing a 10-gallon hat. Mouse been gnawing on my cupboard door. He's been at it now for, I guess, a month or more. When he gets in there, he's sure gonna be sore. There ain't a darn thing in it. It's debts and taxes, and it's pains and woes, aches and miseries, and that's how it goes. And now I got a cold in my nose. Life gets tasteless, don't it? The sun comes up and the sun goes down, and the hands on the clock go round and round. I just get up. It's time to lay down. Life gets tedious, don't it?
Oh, yeah, Doc Watson, an old friend. And that's absolutely right. I'm here to swear to it because I learned the same thing in my childhood, that too much water does weaken one. Well, now, it was a dark and a stormy night. Hand to God, it was a dark and a stormy night. It was in Saratoga Springs, New York, along about 27, 28 years ago, as I recall. It was down in the Tin and Lint Bar on Caroline Street. It was after a show up there at the Cafe Lena. There was a fella in there with me by the name of Johnny Handel. Now, Johnny Handel was a coal miner from the Northumbria, from up there, Newcastle-on-Tyne, on the east coast of Great Britain. And he was in town with a band called the High Level Ranters from their home club, the Ranters Club there in Newcastle-on-Tyne. He played the accordion, and it was a real fine band, and the show was over, and we were down there on the Tin and Link to kind of close the place. We had a few, and Johnny Handel was trying to show me the Northumbrian style of wrestling. It's a kind of grappling. Oh, he bounced me around there quite a while until Tommy Malone, the owner of the bar, came up to us and said we had to stop breaking up the furniture, and we were thrust into the unrelieved darkness, a little worse for the wear. Johnny Handel, besides being a fine musician, was a great storyteller. Now, I have one of his stories. This is one of those longer pieces you see, and how he holds it all in his mind, I don't know. There's a traditional story about Christmas from up there in Newcastle-on-Tyne. It's a Geordie dialect. You might have a little trouble understanding some of this, but then just listen to the lilt of the language. There's enough of it that you can understand that you catch the drift of what he's saying. Johnny Handel in the New Jerusalem.
Arlington to Berwick in the north, and Newcastle was called Jerusalem. There dwelt in a tiny curry village a job and joiner called Joseph. And Joseph could do anything with wood, brethren. He could make a hen cree or a wooden leg out of a pit prop. And some of them even went down in the mines. But around the back end of the year, in the month called December, Joe was laid idle. Moreover, he was redundant, which was worse. They had invented cast iron props, and Joe could deal now with these cast iron props. These chisels was coming instead of gunning, like trying to sex worms. And he went yam to their lass Mary, what lived in number 27 Powathra. That's the address, brethren, it's not the foreign language section. And he says, Mary, Mary, I've been laid idle. Mary's eyes started burning, and her knuckles whitened on the rolling pin. Didn't ye tell me you're out of work when I've planted a gun on the bush trip to go and see the lights at Bethlehem? So Joe knew when he was beat, and he slid quietly out the front door to contemplate. Brethren, he was tempted there by the lights of the betting shop on one side and the public house on the other side. But the public house sold Budweiser, so he turned his back on that, because he'd never liked sulfuric acid. And he went into the betting shop, and he put his money on a horse. It wasn't a horse. It was a Clydesdale crossed with an ostrich. It was long odds. It was 50,000 to one, and it had been a rainy season, so it was running in wellies as well. But Joe fetched in his arse pocket, and he found 4.5 shekels, brethren. And them was the days when you got $14 of a shekel. God bless the British Empire. And he puts his money on that, he says. 4.5 shekels on Hesperus Crint to win. The tannoy stilled. The betting shop went silent. Nobody even rustled their betting slips. It was a melodramatic atmosphere, and very warm as well. And suddenly, 15 minutes later, out spake the tannoy like Kenny Goldstein telling a story that is collected from somebody else. It said, Hesperus Crint has won with 6 lengths to spare. I told you it was a big horse. And Joe goes up to the pit and he gets the wheelbarrow and he piles it high with shekels. And he goes tappy-lappy down the lorin and he busts the door open and there he hoys all the shekels on the clippy mat. He threw the money on the carpet. And Mary was pleased. Oh, she was loping. She was loping, which was bad for her in her condition. She says, Joe, we'll be able to go to see the lights at Bethlehem after all. And they went tappy-lappy down the lorin, but they had missed the club bus. So they get the number 3 down to Jerusalem, and they walk down Northumberland Street, and against the Warwick Street, and all the buses to Bethlehem had went. More they had gone, which was worse. So Joe comes up to this bus conductor, he says, come by here, bonny lad. Where's the buses to Bethlehem? Well, please, I am telling you, there are no buses to Bethlehem tonight. He says, I didn't believe ye, your grand lads, but your newcomers to our country. Gone and fetch the gaffer. The gaffer had been playing darts, and he had just missed his last dart, and he was vexed. Don't he come with his inspector suit on, just like Jimmy Rogers on the freight train. What are ye bothering about, he says to Joe and Mary. And Joe squares up to him, he says, look, I want to know if there's any buses gone to Bethlehem. I've got all us here, and just got all the camping gars and lilos and that camera in the rucksack. So the inspector says, look, between Genghis and me, you've got it. In black and white, there's no buses gone to Bethlehem the night. But there's one gone to the Bartley roundabout. So they gets the bus 15 miles out of Jerusalem. And there they are, standing hitching. Bugger my, says Joe, it's card. If I'd known, I would have put me long wool nunder pants on. Never mind, he's stamping up and down to get his circulation gone back. And he gans up to this colliery. And there's only one bloke working at the colliery. He's looking after the horses, Galloways. And Joe says to him, hey, have you got any hot Galloways to spare? And the bloke says, I've got old knacker here. He's nae good for nowt. If you shove a guitar up his arse, he'll run forever, but. Well, Joe says, I haven't got a guitar, but a set of Northumbrian pipes. Will that do? Nae bother at all. Money changed hands, and Mary were hoisted on the back. And away they went on top of the Galloway. Tappy-lappy down the London, past devious places in the darkness, brethren. Like Sodom and Godmorah. Or as they're called today, Leeds and Bradford. But there was ring roads around, and away they went on the Galloway. And soon they saw the lights. Well, near the edge of the Red Sea, and there it was, shining in the darkness, all the lights on the seafront, and one part called the Tower, where the lights were shining brighter than ever, and Alan Price was bringing hell out the organ. But never mind, Mary's one of these women who take the festivals and eat all the time, they want hot dogs. She says, Joe, where are we going to eat? Where are we going to sleep? Joe tried all the hotels, and they're going by stars in England. He tried the 5-star, the 4-star, the 3-star, the 2-star, the 1-star, and then he saw Newcastle Brown Ale, the Blue Star, and then he went. The barmaid says, I can't fix you up with a bed, young man, but there's a stable out the back. Off the go. Mary's getting her lilos up and blowing them up, you know, and putting the shaving mirror just at the right angle. And Joe's looking at his watch, like Kenny Goldstein when I'm telling a story. He says, I think I'll go off and catch the last, get the milk for the morning. Off he goes, and Mary's sitting comfortable. You know what it's like, girls, when you get your corsets off and have a good scratch? He knows what I mean. Anyway. So, 5 seconds. Four, would it be two? He's religious, he's a methylated spiritualist, you can tell. So, there's a flash of lightning and a puff of green smoke. And there's this bloke in a psychedelic nightie with wings grand with the back of his back. A halo flying round on his head like one of them caps they wear at the Philly Festival. Where the hell are you, says Mary. A student escaped from the university. No, he says, hello, pet, I'm the angel Gabriel. I've come to tell you nice things, but... She says, what nice things, keeping herself well away from. He says, you're going to have the bear in the neat. The neat, she says, I cannot have it the neat. I've got the midwife laid on it. Yeah, me and I under the National Health. 2 and 6 for one, Ben. 5 bob for twins. 4 pund 3 and 6 if you've been on the fertility pill. Gabriel says, never mind that. He says, yeah, I've got a telegram from him upstairs. Get yourself sorted out and put a bit of air out the lilo. He'll be looking after you. You don't need a midwife. Have you told Joseph about this? Eee, bugger my, she says. I've forgotten the heat of the moment. I warrant you were on heat, pet, he says. Never mind. He says, I'll see Joe, where is he? Joe was in the bar. Brethren, Gabriel tucked his wings in the back of his nighty, pulled his halo down round his neck like beads, like he was on a peace mission, and he walked into that bar. Joe had been tempted. He had been tempted by the one-armed bandit, brethren, and he had lost his last shekel, and he wasn't listening to anybody that would buy him a pint. Gabriel had 4.5 shekels in his knicker-leg pocket. So he gans in and hoists him on the bar and says, 2 bottles of brew. Him and Joe were soon wheel acquaint. And in the corner, Gabriel, being an intelligent man and wanting him to have the good news first, let him win. Then he says, your lass is going to cope the neat. She's going to have a baby. It isn't the foreign language section. You're all right. So Joe was a bit barked about that, but never mind. At 10:30, brethren, they were cast from the light into the darkness because it was drinking up time. I know Joe was well used of a bottle of brew or two, but Gabriel was like a folk singer on tour. He'd been a long time off it. And he was all over the place. All over the place. And he starts flapping his wings and he couldn't get off the ground. You know, it was like one of them trips to the Bahamas where you're waiting at the airport all the time. Anyway, Joe says, I'll tell you what, I'll wring your wings out of all them beer fumes. And he was in a dreadful state. He says, God will be very vexed at me if I go up with spot on me nighty. So he picks his handbag up. And he says, I'm going to have a walk over the fells to clear me head. He'd been gone past the wood 7 mile over the fells, and he come across these 3 blokes sitting round a primer stove in the dark. What fettle of dee, says me bunny lads, kicking over the stove, because he was still well on. And the charge on shepherd says, where the hell are ye? The student escaped from the university, or what? He says, no, I'm the angel Gabriel. You read about me in the Boston Gazette. Personal columns. And he pulls it out of his neck a leg pocket. There was written, personal columns. Get yourself to Bethlehem as sharp as ever you can. Grand opens. The bairn's going to be born the neat. Directions. Follow the blue star and in very small print. Always read the small print. Free beer. Free beer, says the lads. And away the shepherd's gone with a willy starting off the rocks. They get to the stable. The bairn had been born. It was the bonniest bairn you ever did wish to see. And Mary was looking at the bairn and looking at the bairn. And they're all saying, what are the car lap? That's a nice bairn. She says, I didn't know there's any instructions. Come with it. And the charge on shepherd, he was about as big as this chap from the Wild West here. He was 6'75", and he's bowing everybody in like the gentleman he was, and getting him in the door. And Mary's just looking through the list of names to come to Jay. Jasper, Jehoshaphat, and the charge on shepherd bangs his heel on the door. Jesus, he says. I says, Mary, that's a bloody good name. We'll use that. Jesus. And then the photographers come. The photographers come from the Bethlehem Chronicle, and they wanted everybody to stand still while the magnesium ribbon went off. And Joseph stood at the back like the proud father he thought he was. And up above in heaven, brethren, the angels, they were having a party. They had their nighties tucked in the top of their Y-fronts. And they were making a geek store up and doing the clouds, doing the motor thrant. And Gabriel was sitting on his private cloud, playing the harp like Bob Dylan and his skiffle group. With a crate of Newcastle Brown between his legs. Well, the dim ambush between their legs up there, you know what I mean? And when he didn't know the tunes, he was slicing ostrich eggs through for the sandwiches afterwards. And suddenly, up above it all, there was a great thunderclap. It was the big gaffer he sell. He was going to have wars with them. So all the angels stopped in mid-lope. And a voice rent the clouds. And brethren, I want you to take these very words to your hearts tonight. because these was the words that the big gaffer spake. He looked down at them angels, and a grin creased his old face, and he shouts down at them, "How are you, bonny lads? Carry on loping and singing. Divin stop now, or it's a bottle of brewing up for mesel. It's the best bloody Christmas I've ever had."
Johnny Handel. Did you catch all of that? There is subtle nuance in that. That, by the way, was a 1979 workshop I did with Johnny Handel and Gamble Rogers and Marshall Dodge. The noise that you hear in that, planes flying overhead, and it was just an outdoor stage, little outdoor stage, and of course people kicking the mic stands, and the wind was blowing across the microphones, but that was still a precious jewel that was captured. You know how I feel about modern engineering standards. It's the content that I want. So say Marshall Dodge was on that stage then. Marshall, I've played his material on this program before. He passed away in a bicycling accident in Hawaii. Marshall did the Down East stories, the very dry, droll Maine stories. The Burton Eye records, of which there are many, many, and it was still advertised in Yankee Magazine up in that part of the world. Marshall was a collector of stories. He would collect jokes. He would collect stories from other parts of the country, other parts of the world, squeeze them for either their comic value or their pathetic value, and recontextualize them, put them up there in Maine. He'd sometimes work on a story for a year till he got it where he wanted to be, but he was very, very protective of them while he was working on them. One time he, just casually at that festival in 79, he told me a joke he'd heard, just popped it off. He was standing there. He told me a joke. It didn't occur to me that was one of those that he was going to be working on for the next year. And so I told it to somebody else later in the day, and it got back to Marshall Dodge that I'd done that. He wouldn't speak to me for a year because he thought that I'd stolen that idea from him. And it was just a common joke. Last time I saw Marshall, he was in a little apartment in Boston, and he sold me his banjo. He'd been trying to learn the classical banjo from old Paul Cadwell. It was a Sloan Foldjo, wouldn't you know, from Chicago. A Sloan banjo that broke into four parts, hinged, folded up into itself, into a small square box, and the tolerances were so fine that when you took that banjo out and stretched it out and set the pins and popped the bridge up, it was in tune. It was a piece of work. In any case, here's Marshall Dodge, and it's your privy.
A certain Mr. Perkins come to my place, a well-to-do gentleman, and asked me if I would build him a new privy. He said his old one was filled up and leaning over. I said, "Where, Mr. Perkins, would you like to build it?" He said, "I'd like to have it over t'other side of the lot by the lilacs, overlooking the road." He said, "It'd be real pleasant in the spring." Well, I said, "Mr. Perkins, it's your privy." I got as fur as the floorboards after digging the hole, and Mr. Perkins come out. He said, "I've been thinking some about this privy, and it seems to me if it's over t'other side of the lot by the lilacs, it'd be pleasant in the spring, but it's so fur from the house that it'd be inconvenient in the winter." He said, "If we had it this side of the lot by the chestnuts, it'd be up close to the house, and be nicer in them cold months." Well, I said, "Mr. Perkins, it's your privy." Well, I filled in the hole and carried the superstructure over to a new hole over by the chestnuts this side of the lot. Mr. Perkins, he come out. By the time I'd got to the roofing, he said, "You know, I've been thinking some more about this privy of mine, and what with the prevailing wind being south-southwest and the house standing just north-northeast of that privy," he said, "you know, it's going to be awful inconvenient for the ladies in the summer months when they do their cooking in the kitchen." He said, "I think if we had the privy halfway between the lilacs and the chestnuts, then neither would it be too fur in the winter nor too close in the summer." Well, I said, "Mr. Perkins, it's your privy." I got as fur as what you might call the interior decorating on that compromise privy, halfway between the lilacs and the chestnuts, when Mr. Perkins come out, and God, he was het up. He was angry, all feathered out. He said, "Concern it, Virgie," he said, "I told you from the very start that I wanted a two-hole privy. Now, why did you build me a one-holer?" "Well," I said, "Mr. Perkins, if I had built you a two-holer and you had come out to it some night, shall we say, pressed for time, you know, Mr. Perkins, before you made up your goddamn mind which one of them two holes are set on, it'd be too late, that's all."
Marshall Dodge, boy, I miss working with him. I certainly do. And that's just an old story idea that he worked around to make it come out the way he wanted for his part of the country. We did talk about that a number of times, both on and off the stage. I said, these people that you have in your stories, Marshall, are they real people? I know that they might not be real stories, but are they real people? And, he said that they were, and I understood exactly what that meant. If I was to take... just a common comic motif, and twerk it around to my part of the world so it came out the way I wanted it, I tend to use people that really exist, so that when I tell a story, I have the vision of those people in my mind, the way they act, the way they talk, the way that they are. My general rule has been that when I'm going to use somebody in a story, I go to them and I tell them that I want to do that. I ask permission and I tell them the story and I say, "You don't mind being in the story?" Because sometimes I have these people that I've known doing things that they would never do on this mortal earth. By and large, I've been given permission to go ahead and do that. Now, Josie Bates is a real person who kept the Enaville Resort over there by Kellogg, Idaho, up there, little Enaville, big log lodge. Idaho Blackie. An old wobbly who kept the wood lot over at Post Falls, Idaho, where I used to cut my wood, two very fine, very remarkable people, but they're a thread throughout a whole cycle of stories that I love to tell. Josie Bates and Idaho Blackie were of a highly lethal temperament, a very highly lethal temperament. They would send them out on a picnic. They'd get at each other with the butter knives. Well, we finally got them hitched. They were both in their 90s. We wanted to get them married so that they would take it out on each other and leave the rest of us out of it. We sent them on their first year's honeymoon up into the Selkirks over in northern Washington State, riding on horseback. Now, Josie had ridden a horse every day of her life for at least 80 years, and she never used but one spur. She always said, "If I can get one side of this horse moving, the other side is apt to follow along." Idaho Blackie was on the lead horse, with the real sharp wind blowing. And Josie noticed that every now and then Idaho Blackie would reach around under his horse's tail and rub his finger around and then dab his lips. Well, she knew he was born to the wilderness. You learn how to doctor yourself out in those parts. Finally, she couldn't take it anymore, and she yelled up, "Idaho Black, rein up, hold up a minute." And he reined up, and she loped up beside him and said, "Now, Blackie, I know you've got the worst set of chapped lips God ever created." And they were wicked. The wind had turned them into lace hanging down there in shredded flesh. "You got the worst set of chapped lips that God ever created, but I see every now and then you stick your finger under the horse's tail and rub it around and dab your lips, and I want to know what earthly good that does." "Well," Josie Blackie said, "keeps me from licking my lips." Now, you're not going to hear that on your Bonanza, folks. Tales of the Old West. Ha-ha. Now, that's an old story idea, and it fits into many, many larger stories. One of the things that happened with storytelling after music hall, coming into vaudeville, coming into the radio comedians and motion pictures, is that stories that used to stand by themselves, that used to be dramatic or even funny, but with the comedy contained in the body of the story, wound up with punchlines. And there are a lot of storytellers that move stories around so that there is a payoff. Now, that's something that's been done to us. It's very, very difficult to get stories back to as they originally were. You see it in stand-up comedy. Stories with punchlines use a lot of throwaways to get you to the punchlines, one-liners. Stand-up, which I regard as a really debased form, is mainly just throwaways. I think that everything, absolutely everything, comedy included, has got to get slower, quieter, and simpler. Slow, quiet, simple. Well, that's Catherine Windham. I recently spent time with her in Mansfield, Pennsylvania at a big storytelling festival. Catherine Windham is an elderly woman, about 86. She's from Selma, Alabama, called the Ghost Woman of Alabama. She's been all through the South collecting ghost stories and other stories. She tells stories reflecting upon her childhood in Selma. I was sitting at the sidelines up at that festival having a conversation. She told me that during the Great Depression, when everybody was starving, she and other ladies of Selma would go over to the black side of town. The town was segregated then, to the black side of town when school was in session, and take food over to feed the kids lunch because they knew there wasn't any food in the houses. She told me that there was one of those little black kids that was proud. And he'd say, no, I'm going to go home and have lunch. And he would go and hide around a corner of a building until the bell rang to go back into school. He said, all except times when his parents went out of town, which he looked forward to because then he could stay and eat lunch. And Catherine Windham said, you know, that story was told to me by James Perkins, who was just elected the first black mayor of Selma, Alabama. Slower, quieter, simpler. Let's listen to Catherine Windham. Listen to the morning.
I got sweet, sweet dewberries, nice and fresh. I got tomatoes, fresh green peppers. I got juicy sweet pears and nice fresh dewberries for sale. I got peas and okra, snap beans and squash, roast and eel and sweet potatoes. I got sweet, sweet dewberries, nice and fresh. I got tomatoes, fresh green peppers. I got juicy sweet pears and nice fresh dewberries for sale.
Every now and then I hear mothers talking about, well, really bragging about how well their babies sleep and their children sleep. They sleep all night and sleep until 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. And I listen to those tales with just amazement because I never had a baby that slept or a child that slept. They somehow did not realize that nighttime was for sleeping. And even when they learned to sleep all night long, they would wake up at the first showing of the dawn. By 5 o'clock, every child I ever had was wide awake and ready for the day. And I guess it's pretty good that I got up because I had a good many chores to do with three little children very near the same age. But I remember one morning when my little boy was maybe 5 years old. I heard him stirring in his room about daylight, and I started to get up, and he called me very gently, Mother, don't get up. Lie still and listen to the morning. And I lay there, and I listened, and I heard some blue jays quarreling out in the backyard. I heard our cat meowing. I heard the newspaper boy coming down the street on his bicycle and hitting the screen door with the paper. And it reminded me of all the sounds I've heard early listening to the morning. I remember being down in the river swamps fishing. Down there, your guide or your boat paddler down in southwest Alabama, down in those forks of the Alabama and the Tom Bigby, will say to you, I'll meet you down here at the boat landing, at the first singing of the birds, or at the second singing of the birds. Because down there they measure those early morning hours in that way. There comes before the real dawn, a false dawn, when it begins to get a little light, and the birds in the swamp wake up and they begin to sing. The red bird sings first. And then all the birds sing, and the whole swamp is filled with music. And then it gets very dark again, and there's absolute silence there. And then the real dawn comes, and they sing again. And I remember listening to the morning down there. And I remember listening to the morning later in Selma when the vegetable vendors would come around and they'd call out, I got cabbages and peas, beans and okra. Oh, I got fresh dewberries. And there were beautiful sounds early in the morning. And I still like when I awaken early to lie still and listen to the morning.
Blind Kenny Hall doing her intermission music once again. Blind Kenny Hall from Fresno, California. I mentioned that I had been at a storytelling festival in Mansfield, Pennsylvania. That's in North Central, just shy of the New York border in Elmira, New York. I had a lot of time to roam around the town and talk to people. I had a good set with the old town historian there, the informal historian, Mr. Bailey. It's a good time to get stories, you know. These trips out of town. This radio show is a chance for me to talk. The trips out of town are a chance for me to listen so that when I come back, I have something to talk about. I'll give you a story that I picked up back there in Mansfield. There was a company of soldiers that was raised, volunteers were raised during the Civil War in Mansfield, and they went off to fight. It was on some battlefield of the South, lost in the woods, that they encountered a Confederate company of soldiers that were similarly lost, separated from their units. They engaged in a pitched battle. They fought all day, well into the evening, until they were all dead, with the exception of two, one Confederate and one Union soldier, facing each other, bodies drenched with sweat, covered with the blood of their comrades, with their muskets leveled with the bayonets on the end as they... They were so tired they could hardly hold up their muskets. And one said to the other, "Why don't we get some rest? Just lie down and sleep for a while, and then in the morning we'll take this up again and settle it." So they lay down there exhausted amidst all of their fallen comrades. And as they began to drift off, they talked. "Where are you from?" "Oh, from Cherokee County, North Carolina." "Yeah, well, I'm from Mansfield up there. What do you do down there?" "Well, I do a little bit of farming and a little bit of trapping. I don't see how we're going to get a crop in this year. My older boy was lost down there at Chancellorsville. And you, well, my brother was lost over there at Cold Harbor. I don't know if I'll ever make it back home myself. I work on making boats to work the canal system to haul the coal to the train so it could be carried up to the glassworks at Corning, New York." Well, they talked like that, you know, until they finally lulled themselves to sleep. And they woke up in the morning. They got up, shook themselves out, picked up their muskets with their bayonets on them, and turned and faced each other. And they stood silently. And finally, after some length of time, they both laid their rifles on the ground and turned around and walked away. Well, I guess you can't hurt somebody when you know their story. The two soldiers. Now, is that story real? Did that really happen? Well, does it matter? Now, that's actually a very, very old story. That story comes from Europe. That story has been all over the world in one form or the other. But does the story have meaning, regardless of whether it happened or not? Reality isn't all that it's cracked up to be. Look at us. Look at us. What has reality ever done for anybody? God. The storyteller's creed. We have earned the right to make up as much reality as we could possibly get away with. Ha ha. Well, all right. It's another old story, idea. And with that little nugget of truth in it that can transform your life if you listen closely. Let's listen to Blackie and his fridge. Well, I'm going to head up into that country in January, and I'm going to go over there and try to get Burt Russell, who's another old IWW Harrison Flats, Idaho, but he's a good writer, to write an introduction for this book. Yeah, I'm going to try to get it done, and I've tracked down Blackie's doctor, a young family practice physician named Jim Shaw, and I'm going to talk to him some more. He can steer me toward Blackie's old cronies so I can flesh these stories out, see, before I commit the rest of them to paper. Shaw saw Blackie when he was 92 years old, and Dr. Shaw said to me, you know, he's the picture of health. He did such healthy work in the forest, and the job didn't kill him. He survived. And the only thing I worry about is his mind. He said something I don't think any old wobbly would ever say. I said, what was that? He said, well, he told me the only problem he's got is that he has to get up at night and go to the bathroom. But he said, the Lord watches out for me, turns on the light for me, and turns it out when I'm done. Well, I said, yeah, that's a damned odd thing for any old wobbly to say. But Dr. Shaw said he'd talked to Josie Bates, Blackie's wife, and older than him by a good bit, and said, Josie, now, you know, Blackie has the body of a 40-year-old, but I fear for his mind. And tells me when he gets up at night to go to the bathroom that the Lord turns on the light for him and turns it out when he's done. Josie said, that old fool pissing in the refrigerator again? Yeah. And that gives you an idea of the transformative quality of a story, doesn't it? It can change your life. The other member of the triumvirate, me and Marshall Dodge, was, as I mentioned before, a number of occasions, Gamble Rogers. Gamble Rogers was down there in St. Augustine, Florida, his home. He was resting in a tent on the beach, and a little girl came up on the beach screaming and crying, save my father, save my father. And without thinking, Gamble jumped up with an inflatable mattress and ran into the waves. Now, he had been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis when he was still a teenager, and it was getting progressively worse until his spine was becoming fused. Nonetheless, he waded into the water and started to paddle out there, and of course a wave came up and pitched him off, and that was how Gamble Rogers left us, and left an enormous void in the storytelling world. He was the most skilled monologist. Well, Gamble's more than able to speak for himself. Let's listen to a little bit of Gamble Rogers.
I'm terribly sorry to admit to you folks that I learned this song off a deputy sheriff from DeKalb County, Georgia. That damn fool arrested me. He had every high-performance accessory known to mankind on his county pursuit vehicle. He had Goodyear polyglass wide boot series 60 tires, a foot and a half wide. With the big white letters on the side of each tire, it said, Redneck. He had mag wheels, hooker headers, cherry bomb resonators, Delco airlift pleasurizers, spring shackles, chrome tailpipe extensions, four-speed gear shift, a high-rise manifold, a four-barrel carburetor, and a Le Mans racing stripe. On his Massey Ferguson tractor. He got off that thing. He swaggered up to me. He said, boy, don't you be talking spiteful and nasty and mean at me like none of them hippy-dip communist punks come through here every day from Macon. Driving them Volkswagen microbotic buses, all them sleeping bags and chemical commodes in the bed of them like some kind of mobile orgy. I was writing out a ticket to one of them long-haired fruits. He leaned out the window. He say, baby, give me 5 cheeseburgers and a Coke. I pull him out of that contraption and chucked his butt through a Wake Up America billboard. Now, this was some kind of heavy dude I was talking to. I'd say by the clothes he had on, he was a primitive man. He was wearing a breech clout made out of 2 Fruhoff mud flaps. He's wearing a styrofoam pith helmet with an STP decal on the front. Tom McCann loafers with quarters stuck in the top. And he was well armed in the tradition of the Georgia law. Over his bare chest, he had two 45 caliber bandolier belts with the cartridge loops alternately stuffed with Havatampa jewels and Slim Jims. He said, son, I ain't gonna give you no ticket. You're a homeboy. I'll let you off with a traffic warning citation. Now, in DeKalb County, Georgia, these warning citations printed up in the form of bumper stickers. He went back to the tractor and he got me a citation, peeled the brown paper off the back and licked it just one time. Slopped it over the back of my car. I went back and read it later. It said, eat more possum.
Gamble Rogers. That whole festival back there at Mansfield I just came from was dedicated to Gamble, and we had a wonderful, wonderful memorial. And all of his stories and his songs, he was a tremendous Merle Travis-style guitar player, has all been reissued on his own label, by the way, by the fellow that worked with Gamble as an agent for many, many years. Well, now, as we get down to the bottom of the program, I was invited to be in a theater festival in San Francisco along with Rosalie Sorrells, and I spent a couple of days listening to some of the finest stories I ever heard in my life that were done as theater pieces. One of them was by Annie Galjour from Pointe-aux-Chenes, the dog leg of Louisiana, a wonderful one-woman play called Hurricane, and it relates the story of going through a hurricane and then the aftermath of the hurricane. She does all six voices, and they're completely distinct from each other. The piece that we're going to hear just has a couple of those voices, but we're going to listen to the end of that piece, which comes right after the hurricane. Annie Galjour.
They made us turn back at the pumping station. I can't find Michael. I can't find him. I can't.
It was so sad. I was in Inez and Sherelle's kitchen making the coffee and heating up the milk. I looked out the window. The sky was so blue that if it wasn't for all the shingles blowing on the grass and the water rising so high in the canal, you never would have known we passed through a hurricane the night before. The water was so high, I knew it would be quite a while before Marlin and those men could be checking our land for all. Then I got out a tray, and I fixed three cups and saucers and spoons, and I brought it outside on the porch and put it on the little table next to the rocker. It was so sad. Sherelle stroked her sister's hair. She bent over and told her. I did my best to make him look fresh. I put a wave in his hair to try to give it back the bounce. I put a little blush in his lips and his nose. I know he smells a lot like Esther Lauder, but when I punched the hole in his stomach to let out the air, he just started to smell. Then Inez wrapped him in the blanket he always used to love to lie down on to watch the TV. She held him in her arms. She kissed him and she told us, oh, Michael. Michael, how lucky I was to have had the pleasure and the comfort of his good company for 12 years. Then she walked down the steps and buried him in a hole we dug in the ground underneath the oak tree. After we covered him up, we all sat on the porch sipping our coffee. Inez put down her cup and she asked me,
How's Marlin?
I put down my cup, and I put it to her, Inez. They finally found him 50 yards away from Michael's body. The Coast Guard said he was hanging on to a platform with a fistful of Michael's hair in his hand. So you knew he drawed. The Coast Guard brought him to the Lady of the Sea Hospital. Grady went to see him. He said he's fine. They're gonna let him out tomorrow. But Grady said you cannot put another mosquito bite on that man's face. Then we heard gunshots and Sherelle started shaking. I said, calm down. That's a good sound. That's just the alligator patrol doing their job. Now get used to it, Sherelle. We're gonna be hearing that sound a lot in the next few days. Or weeks. It's funny how the hot summer sun could make me feel so cold. I was in my kitchen listening to the radio and hearing gunshots out my window. Where the man was talking about how hurricanes are good. How they clean out the mouth of the Mississippi and push out all the silt that builds up the marsh. I looked out my window at Michael's grave. Thought maybe it was time for me to move away from here. Then I heard a knock at my door. It was Eurus. He was holding some kind of screaming animal in a towel. By the way it was growling, I thought it was a puppy. But when he opened it, I saw it was a baby. It was sunburned and hungry. Give me that child, I said. I undid its diaper. His little weenie and butt were scarlet red from lying in his waist. Eurus touched his little navel and rubbed his little head. I found him in my cow pasture holding on to his little baby blanket. One of my cows was trying to lick him clean. He lay bow, eh?
Well, he lay bow. I turned the water on in the sink. I said, Eurus, go to the store, get me 3 baby bottles, a box of diapers, and a case of pet milk. Oh, yeah, and Eurus, can you get me some more of your eggs? I was noticing this morning they're starting to do wonders on Sherelle's hair. I bathed that baby in chamomile and warm water. I cracked the last of Eurus's eggs, and I rubbed the whites on his weenie and butt to try to pull out the fire. I fed him 3 drops of sweet water and a half a ripe banana. And I had to hold him in my arms because he wouldn't stop screaming. So I rubbed his little head and his back. And I walked out the back door out into the yard. Laid on top of Michael's grave with that little bow just screaming on my chest. But I kissed him. And I rubbed him and I said, it's all right. It's all right, little beau. Lie still. Lie still. Lie still, I kept saying, till his breathing slowed down to the sound of my words. I thought of my Gram and the Chenier Caminata. And that little beau just fell into the lull of the leaves, fluttering.
Yes, this has been Story Time with Utah Phillips and Loafer's Glory, the Hobo Jungle of the Mind. Never forget, Your life is a story. The best you can hope for is that in the end, it will have been well told.